the headlines, confrontation in the Sea of Oman. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps stopping U.S. forces from stealing Iranian crude oil. A Republican winning the race for governor in the U.S. state of Virginia and a setback for President Biden out of next year's congressional elections. And also in our headlines, Russia still struggling to contain the spiraling COVID infections. The country records its highest fatalities in a single day. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Iran says it has blocked U.S. forces from stealing a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps will soon be releasing footage of the incident. The U.S. forces attempted to seize a tanker that was carrying Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman, but the IRGC's naval forces proceeded to guard the tanker carrying out a heliborne operation and steered the vessel toward Iran's territorial waters. The U.S. forces then started chasing the tanker using helicopters and warships, but all their attempts to block the tanker's path or seize it failed. Oil Minister Javad Oji has thanked the IRGC for securing the Iranian shipment. He said the latest incident will strengthen the Iranian government's will to overcome enemy restrictions. Elsewhere, multiple elections have been held in the United States with Republican candidates taking the lead in the gubernatorial race in some key states. The Republican wins signal trouble for Joe Biden's presidency ahead of next year's midterm elections, especially in light of his growing unpopularity.
November 2nd was a landmark day in U.S. politics. Several elections were held, including the race for governor in Virginia and New Jersey, and mayoral polls in cities like New York, Atlanta, Boston, and Pittsburgh. In Virginia, Republican Glenn Youngkin has garnered enough votes to win the battle against his Democratic rival Terry McAuliffe. To win over voters during a campaign speech in Chantilly, Youngkin said he will work to improve the living standards of his fellow citizens, a promise that would strike a chord with many people.
We are going to keep our communities safe. We're going to comprehensively fund law enforcement because they stand up for us, and we are going to stand up for them.
Another Republican victory was registered in New Jersey, where Jack Citarelli took a lead over incumbent Democratic rival Governor Phil Murphy. Mayoral races were also held in several cities, including New York City. There, Eric Adam, a Democrat, managed to win the highly contested vote. Virginia's gubernatorial race is traditionally viewed as a crucial barometer of the president's national standing. That takes on added importance against the backdrop of the latest polls indicating a drop in Biden's approval rating, the lowest level of his presidency. The president's loss of support, driven by his much-criticized messy pullout from Afghanistan and the Americans' economic concerns, is seen by many as the cause of the Republican resurgence in these elections.
Let's take a look at what's been happening. He had failures in Afghanistan when there was an attack where several service members were killed. We still have an economy that's still not up and running the way that people would like. We have issues when it comes to his infrastructure bill. It seems that pieces of the infrastructure bill keep getting taken out. And a lot of people are wondering what is going on with the promises coming from the Biden administration.
With Republicans winning in Virginia and New Jersey, the control of Congress and the fate of President Biden's agenda will be at stake. Many see the GOP wins in the gubernatorial race as not only a loss for Biden, but also a blow to the whole Democratic Party and the run-up to the next year's midterm vote.
So the fact that Youngkin will be the governor, likely the governor of Virginia, won over so many independent voters is mind-blowing. But in a lot of ways, it's also not, because Biden has failed, the Democrats have failed the people of Virginia, what's called the Rust Belt. And so they're looking for an alternative. I don't believe that the Republicans are the proper alternative. But it's still expressing the will of the people that they're not satisfied with the Democrats.
The United States has been grappling with a whole host of issues, including economy ahead of education, taxes, and the COVID pandemic. Racial injustice and rising consumer prices are among other public concerns. What would the failure of the Biden administration to address those issues it is highly likely that the 2024 presidential race will be a tight one.
We're going to go back to our previous story for this half hour, as Iran says it has blocked U.S. forces from stealing a shipment of Iranian oil in the Sea of Oman. Writer and political analyst John White is joining us now on the line from Edinburgh. Mr. White, give us your thoughts on the incident, and what are the motives behind such an attempt by Washington?
I think this is definitely geared towards the resumption of the nuclear deal talks, with the view to trying to resurrect the JCPOA that was negotiated by the Obama administration when Joe Biden was vice president, and was unceremoniously destroyed by the Trump administration when it unilaterally pulled out of the deal and then introduced stringent sanctions against Iran on a policy known as maximum pressure. It seems like that policy did not die with the Trump administration's departure from the White House. It seems the Biden administration is following that policy, maybe hoping to weaken Iran's negotiating position at these talks that are set to resume at the end of November. It's a very reckless gamble. It's a very reckless move. It's an act of international brigandage, and all right-thinking people and governments should certainly have something to say about this. This is a violation of international law. It's a violation of Iran's sovereignty, and it's an act of war, pure and simple.
And Mr. White, who benefits from such acts of destabilization and meddling in the Persian Gulf region and in the, looking at further, in the Middle East region altogether?
Well, clearly the Israelis have been lobbying fiercely the Biden administration over its attempt to resurrect the Iran nuclear deal. And also the Saudis will benefit from this because they will keep Iran's oil off the market. But the problem that they have is that the Biden administration is weak at home right now. That's the problem that the Iran and all the other participants in the talks have. And the Biden administration is looking to shore up its failing polling in the U.S. So perhaps it thinks it can wield a strong hand against Iran as an external enemy, with a clear attempt to try and increase popularity at home. You know, the market of fear always demands monsters, and this is what the Americans are doing. I do fear for the future of the Iran nuclear deal. The fact that the Biden administration is not sitting down directly with Iran and is negotiating through European intermediaries, that gives me great cause for concern. It's time, I think, for Iran to start looking at other options and see the Iran nuclear deal for what it is, dead and buried.
We have to focus on the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Yeah. That's the policy they've been following for a couple of years now. When we see such outlandish measures like the one we saw in the Sea of Oman, we have to believe that maybe even the United States thinks that the maximum pressure campaign against Iran has failed. Unpack that for us, please.
Well, you're talking about the sanctions. Of course, the Iranians are not going to bow. That's their pride in the eyes of Washington and its allies. And so they may be trying other tactics. They're upping the ante, so to speak. And they're going for a military option to try and roll back Iran's growing influence in the region and less reliance on U.S. largesse, again, at the behest of the Israeli government and its Saudi counterpart, with regional ambitions in mind. But Iranians will not be minded to back down. Certainly not this new government will not. And so it's going to be very, very, very interesting to see what happens. Very dangerous time, very reckless, but the Iranians probably have no other option other than to resist these acts of aggression.
All right, thanks a lot, writer and political analyst John White, joining us on the line from Edinburgh. Elsewhere, Palestinian families are turning down an Israeli proposed deal on their homes in a neighborhood in Al-Quds, saying the offer is only meant to justify occupation at their expense.
We rejected the compromise offered to us by the court of the occupation, which considers us as protected tenants renting from the settlers' organization and which will lead to the confiscation of our right in our lands. We reject because we believe in our cause and our right to our home and country, despite that we're not getting any guarantees to support our steadfastness as Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem from any side or organization.
Israel has for months been seeking to evict four Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and give their land to settlers. The families say the deal is unjust because it's meant to force them into recognizing the settlers' ownership of their lands. Hamas says rejecting the deal is the right decision to make, and that by doing so, these families are avoiding the political trap set by Israel. Hamas is asking all Palestinians to support them. Israel's Supreme Court has proposed that the Palestinian families remain in their homes for 15 years in exchange for rent. They were given until November the 2nd to make their decision. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says the Israeli decision to evict Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah will likely ignite new clashes between local residents and the Israeli settlers. Listen.
They are now urging the international community to intervene. They are saying that the Palestinians across the occupied territories in Al-Quds should stand with them, and this is what's going on. Palestinians are saying that the Israeli court's decision is illegal, and they support the Palestinian families, and they will continue to protect them to remain in their homes. But the fears now that the family's refusal of the Israeli decision might cause the clashes between other settlers illegally living in their homes inside the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. But up to the moment, the Palestinian families made their decision clear. They will not leave their homes, and they will not accept the Israeli court's decision to pay rent for settler groups for 15 years, because after 15 years, this means they will be forced to leave their homes, and that the Israeli regime will confiscate the land and the homes and bring settlers to illegally live instead of them.
Elsewhere, it's been 104 years since British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his infamous declaration giving Israeli settlers the permission to usurp Palestinian land. Asher Shannon has more in this following report.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for their pain and suffering for more than seven decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians.
The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
With the Israeli military targeting the Damascus countryside with a second missile strike in just a few days, the airstrike was launched from the northern parts of the occupied Palestine early Wednesday. Syrian media are quoting military sources as saying that the strike targeted a post in the Zakiya neighborhood near Damascus. The attack has caused some material damage. No word on possible casualties. Just days ago, Syrian air defenses intercepted Israeli surface-to-surface missiles over the same area. Two soldiers were injured in that attack. Israel frequently launches missile strikes on Syria. Damascus has been demanding action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military sites as well as resistance fighters battling terrorists. The UN Rights Chief is concerned about the extreme brutality of the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region, warning of, quote, possible crimes against humanity by all sides.
We have reasonable grounds to believe that during this period, all parties to the Tigray conflict have committed violations of international human rights, humanitarian, and refugee law. Some of these may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Russia's daily COVID toll hitting another record high as the new wave of the pandemic seems to be nowhere near subsiding. Nearly 1,200 people losing their lives to the virus in the past 24 hours. That's the 15th consecutive day the country is seeing over 1,000 fatalities. The total tally is now above 242,000. There have also been over 40,000 daily infections. The overall caseload is above 8.6 million. Russian officials are struggling to contain the surge, reimposing a partial lockdown nationwide. Elsewhere in Europe, the Czech Republic is recording its highest daily infection since March, with around 10,000 cases. Also, Poland's daily cases topped 10,000 for the first time since April. Well, that's a wrap for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday, 1st of November, attempted to reinvigorate global commitments to fight climate change by pledging that the U.S. is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example at a conference in Glasgow, Scotland. Joe Biden also apologized for former President Donald Trump's withdrawal of the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. The article you're about to hear has been written by Cecilia Smith-Schoenwalder, a journalist writing about health and the environment for U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, Biden Apologizes for Trump's Withdrawal of the U.S. from the Paris Agreement on Climate Change. U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday, 1st of November, attempted to reinvigorate global commitments to fight climate change by pledging that the United States is not only back at the table, but hopefully leading by the power of our example at a conference in Glasgow, Scotland. Joe Biden also apologized for former President Donald Trump's withdrawal of the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. I know it hasn't been the case, and that's why my administration is working overtime to show that our climate commitment is action and not words, Biden said at the Global Climate Change Summit in Glasgow, known as COP26, likely referencing his predecessor, Donald Trump. He also apologized for Donald Trump's removal of the United States from the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, which Biden recommended to on his first day in office. I guess I shouldn't apologize, but I do apologize for the fact that United States in the last administration pulled out of the Paris Accords and put us sort of behind the eight ball, Biden said. He also noted that given the U.S. history of actions such as deforestation that have sped up climate change, the nation has an obligation to act now. Specifically, the United States and other nations need to step up financing for other countries that have not had the opportunity to do as much damage as we have had, he said. Despite his efforts to lead by example, Joe Biden has been struggling to get countries like Russia and China to come to the table to make stronger climate pledges. On Sunday, he expressed disappointment to reporters over the nation's lack of new commitments to handle climate change. The Biden administration on Monday released its long-term strategy to achieve a net-zero economy by 2050. His administration has also committed to halving greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. Biden ran over his time limit at both of his appearances on Monday at the summit, but Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is hosting the event, made a case for allowing the president to take his time. Everybody will understand the huge importance of the United States in helping the world to take action and show solidarity, Boris Johnson said. The goal of the summit is to encourage governments to commit to actions that limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. However, the United Nations-appointed Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change wrote in a report in August of this year that the global temperatures have already jumped 1.1 degrees Celsius since the 19th century to reach their highest level in over 100,000 years. Climate experts agree that immensely more action is needed for there to be a chance at curbing rising temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius. If achieved in full and on time, already announced pledges will start to bend the global emissions curve down, the International Energy Agency IEA wrote in a commentary ahead of the summit. But the pledges to date, even if fully achieved, fall well short of what is required to bring global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions to net zero by 2050 and give the world an even chance of limiting the global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Concerns over climate inaction have been growing in response to how the COVID-19 pandemic has played out. The pandemic has taught us that national solutions to global problems do not work, Barbados's Prime Minister Mia Mottley said at the summit in Glasgow. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres added that the recent climate action announcements might give the impression that we are on track to turn things around, but he said, this is an illusion.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing on the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance, the Charter of Islamic Civilization. And we are taking our inspiration from the different sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. One of those sermons is sermon number 87. In this sermon, Imam Ali alayhi salam explains the situation of the communities before the coming of Islam. Imam Ali alayhi salam explains what those communities were facing, the types of tests and trials, the types of ignorance that they had, the type of apparent progress that would seem to look like a form of development, but in reality it wasn't. He talks about those issues that they were facing and how Islam came and solved those problems, and how it is important for us today to think about the fact that if we have the same issues facing the world today, then we need something to help us solve that. In one of those phrases, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَالدُّنْيَا كَاسِفَةٌ نُورٌ, that the world at that time was eclipsed from the light. كَاسِفَةٌ نُورٌ, that means the light was blocked. It was engulfed in darkness, despite all the material progress that apparently was there in the empires of the Rome and the Persian. Still it was in darkness. What is this darkness? Inshallah, we will soon discuss about that.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we are being told that the world was in darkness. That means Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling us that the material progress was not the reason, is not the reason for enlightenment of a community. There is something else. The problem was the distance from the teachings of the divine, the actual, you can say, the destruction of the people's reality, the souls of the people, the heart of the people, the hearts of the people was being destroyed. Their affinity towards truth and their ability to go towards the right direction was being destroyed in those environments. And we see that it is happening today also in those so-called progressive countries. One of those strong manifestations of darkness is the imaginary progress that people feel that they are having. Look at the young man that is growing up in a Western civilization. He is being fed constantly with a very fake understanding of progress and felicity and happiness. And a person who lives such a life where always he is being fed with this fake understanding of reality, fake understanding of what is true felicity, such a person slowly begins to turn away from life. And that is why you see that people in the West, in these so-called developed areas, are depressed. A large amount of people in those communities face depression. They need a lot of entertainment to turn them away from the actual pain that they have in their hearts. That's why you see that people are committing suicide. They're committing suicide. So now you get two groups of people. Those who are brave, they end up killing themselves. Those who don't have the bravery to kill themselves in these worlds, in these areas, they end up dying while they are still alive. And their death is in what sense? Their death is in their unawareness. Their death is in their unconsciousness. Their death is in their lack of understanding. Their death is in their addictions, their laxity. This is their death. And it is, you can see the Western civilization is taking mankind towards this form of death. If it is not suicide, then it is death while being still alive.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, another reason, another form of death that we see today, that people are so much engulfed in this darkness, is now you can see because of this dark atmosphere that has been created by this fake understanding of felicity and progress, they have now brought about different forms of spirituality that will kind of attract people. Things like Reiki, things like yoga, things like pranic healing, you know, all these different types of healings that have come today. Because these are things that look like light, but they are not light. Their reality is darkness, but they are being brought about as light. The communities are being fed and made to imagine that these are light. You know, the human imagination is very powerful. If a person were to feed and to make a person and explain a person certain realities and beautify them in such a way that even if it is not good, they can still imagine it as good, this is what the West is doing today. The West is very clever, very smart, very apt in showing the dirtiest things as beautiful, the most murkiest of issues as wonderful and lovable. This is the reality. So now, because of the lack of spirituality, now they've come up with these fake forms of spirituality, yoga and Reiki and all of these things, which have no reality at all. Under the pretext of knowing the self and understanding the soul and understanding your existence, they pull you into this whirlpool of darkness that whose walls seem to be of light, but in reality are not like that. This is something that is very dangerous also that we are facing today, these fake forms of spirituality. Inshallah, in the next session we will discuss slightly in touch on these issues. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من الحاسم أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In many ways, the immigration crisis is the latest chapter in a rolling history of the U.S. interventionism. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jonathan N.G. Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Haiti's Humanitarian Crisis Reveals Human Costs of U.S. Interventionism. Stay tuned for more. This September, U.S. Border Patrol agents violently seized Haitian refugees along the Rio Grande, attracting fierce criticism and international attention. Officers on horseback trotted through families, wielded their reins as whips, and chased migrants carrying their meager possessions in plastic bags. After scandalizing public opinion, President Joe Biden deemed the operation outrageous and promised that the border agents will pay. Yet, behind the scenes, his administration has swiftly deported thousands of Haitians. Authorities frequently exploit Title 42 of the Public Health Services Law to expel refugees seeking asylum. "We're doing this out of a public health need," claims U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, adding it is not an immigration policy. But in practice, the legal subterfuge has allowed Customs and Border Protection, CBP, to turn historic numbers of migrants away. Recently, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in protest, denouncing the inhumane, counterproductive policy. Since then, humanitarian crisis has only deepened. Blocked from reaching the U.S., Haitians now constitute the second largest group seeking protection in Mexico. For most, the border is simply the latest stretch in a grueling continental odyssey. Many traveled across Latin America on swollen ankles, braved discrimination, and survived unspeakable adversity. and now they wait. Observers routinely cite Haiti's recent earthquake, grinding poverty and political upheaval for the immigration crisis, but neglect an essential factor. While U.S. officials jealously guard the Texas border, they have not hesitated to violate Haiti's. In many ways, the immigration crisis is the latest chapter in a rolling history of U.S. interventionism. For over a century, the United States has decisively shaped Haitian affairs. Fearing political instability, Woodrow Wilson sent Marines in 1914 to relocate the Haitian National Bank's holdings to New York. A year later, they invaded Haiti to protect the investments of Western creditors, initiating a two-decade occupation that entailed the ruthless suppression of dissent and wholesale transfer of assets to U.S. corporations. Ultimately, the U.S. left a legacy of militarism, saddling the island with a bloated army that repeatedly intervened in politics. Haitian legislators approved the law reorganizing the military under U.S. pressure. The constabulary shall be organized and officiated by Americans, the act crisply stated. Racism inflamed fears of political instability, ostensibly justifying U.S. intervention, and indelibly shaped the occupation. Commander Smedley Butler waxed paternal, later claiming that occupiers were trustees of a huge estate that belonged to miners. As Butler filled the army with Haitian recruits, he called his subordinates little chocolate soldiers and elsewhere described himself as the chief of police force. The U.S. Marines withdrew in 1934, but the Haitian military continued exerting preponderant influence over island politics. In 1957, the army swept François Dolivre into office through rigged elections. Until 1986, the Dolivre family retained power by creating a personal paramilitary force and turning the army into a privileged caste. As a former political prisoner Robert Duval observed, traditionally the army of Haiti was always the one that gave and took political power. U.S. military intervention returned after Jean-Bertrand Aristide became president in 1991. The Salesian priest secured national stature during the dwindling days of the Dolivre dictatorship for his advocacy for the poor. Yet his liberation theology, reformist agenda, and critical independence alarmed the U.S., which backed his removal in September 1991. After Aristide returned to power in 1994, the Clinton administration slipped army and paramilitary records out of the country in order to shield officers from prosecution. The next year, Haiti dissolved its military, yet in early 2004, former officers poised to again oust Aristide. Their leaders included Guy Philippe, who received training from U.S. Special Forces, and Louis Jodl Chamblain, a retired officer who previously led a CIA-backed death squad. Their main goal was to re-establish the military. The Bush administration finished the coup with crude finesse. In February 24, a delegation of U.S. diplomats and troops arrived at Aristide's house. They warned him that rebels were coming and would slaughter his family unless he immediately boarded a U.S. chartered plane. Remarkably, the U.S. delegation refused to protect Aristide despite its air of authority and abundant arms. They had not only the force of the embassy but the Marines with them, Congresswoman Maxine Waters explained, adding they made clear that he had to go now or he would be killed. Indeed, the U.S. embassy obstructed his own security detail. After hastily ushering Aristide to the airport, the delegation refused to let him board without tendering a letter of resignation. The U.S. Navy SEAL escort then held him incommunicado for nearly 24 hours, denying him access to a telephone and spreading him out of the country. Aristide called the drama a modern-day kidnapping. His overthrow signaled another turn in the spiral of militarism. While the U.S. military mission consummated the coup, the Bush administration promoted the occupation of the island. 2 months later, it spearheaded the U.S. stabilization mission in Haiti, a formidable force of 9,000 blue helmets. The first independent country in Latin America became the only country in the hemisphere under foreign occupation. While militarizing Haiti's political crisis, the United States of America supported the ruling class that previously identified with the Bolivar dictatorship and bitterly resented Aristide, and both mobilized to prevent his return. According to a secret cable, Chief Edmund Mullet of MINUSTAH urged U.S. legal action against Aristide to prevent the former president from gaining more traction with the Haitian population and returning. Former U.S. Ambassador James Foley agreed in a telegram with the terse titled, "Aristide Movement Must Be Stopped." As leftists rode the pink tide into office across Latin America, the Bush and Obama administrations deemed the Red Priest a threat to the island's pliant ruling class and neoliberalism. Privately, a special U.S. team prepared a dossier on Aristide, scouring his past for criminal activities to sully his reputation. And this summer, the two histories of interventionism intertwined. On July 7th, a band of mercenaries assassinated President Moi of Haiti. Most were veterans of Plan Colombia, and at least seven had received training from the United States of America. Their contractor, CTU Security, is a U.S. firm owned by Antonio Intrigo, a friend of Colombian President and Uribe protege, Ivan Duque. One leader, Captain German River Garcia, recalled their chilling orders. Everyone had to be killed, the police, the prison security, everything we encountered in the house. Another participant explained that there could be no witness. Following the assassination, Haitian Prime Minister Claude Joseph requested the U.S. and the U.N. send troops, eliciting widespread opposition. An organization representing retired military officials encouraged Haitians to reject the humiliation of foreign intervention. Yet, on August 14th, another earthquake gripped Haiti. In response, the U.S. sent Marines. They brought the USS Arlington, MH-60 Seahawk helicopters, P-8A Poseidon planes, and other military equipment, prompting observers to doubt their humanitarian mission. The cycle of crisis in Haiti and Colombia reveals that interventionism is not simply an event by a system. Incredibly, the United States Southern Command both trains Colombian troops and oversees humanitarian aid in Haiti. As the situation deteriorates, Haitians have sought refuge in the U.S. No destination on earth is more attractive for a Haitian. The island's daily low Novosteel reports, adding, yet the refugees along the Texas border all think that the USA is largely responsible for their hardship and the sad state of their country. The latest chapter in the history of U.S. interventionism is neither tragedy nor farce, but defies literary convention. And yet the immigration crisis is cruelly poetic. Haitians are fleeing the violence of interventionism by running to its source.
Just listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In one of our previous episodes, we spoke about a tradition that revolved around a person and the need of the person to aid and to assist those who are oppressed and to go against those who are obviously oppressing and who are wronging. And the reward of such will be that a person will be with the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam in paradise, in his position, or rather with the Holy Prophet as one of the Holy Prophet's companions. Now in this tradition, we would like to mention the opposite, in that a person who supports a wrongdoer, a person who supports an oppressor, now this doesn't have to be, you know, a physical type of support or monetary. It can be something just like aiding in holding the umbrella for that person also, as we will see in another tradition that will be mentioned in a future episode, inshallah. But in this tradition, it shows that, you know, the smallest assistance towards an oppressor will include you amongst the people who are counted as the aiders and the supporters of that oppressor or of that wrongdoer. So we see in this tradition from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, was reported to have said that on the day of resurrection, on the day of judgment, a caller will call out, "Where are the wrongdoers and their helpers?" So we see again here, it is not just the wrongdoer who will be called out, also those who supported them. Now obviously, if a person physically helps a wrongdoer, he himself becomes a wrongdoer. So why is helpers included here? There must be a difference between the two sets of people. And then the caller will explain what he means by helpers and say, whoever prepared the ink well for them, the smallest thing as bringing a pot of ink so that the oppressor can write a particular verdict or edict in order to do something oppressive, this is considered as helping the oppressor. Or tied the purse for them. For example, a bag was brought, that there was something in this bag for this oppressive tyrant or for this oppressor or for this wrongdoer. And a person merely just tied this bag up itself or tied it to the horse or to a vehicle. Or if you want to put it in today's words, he helped put something inside the car, for example. Or supplied them with a pen, a tool, an instrument. Gather them all together with them. All of these people who did this for the oppressors, for the wrongdoers, they must be gathered with those wrongdoers. And we know that their gathering place will be the fire of hell. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to assist us in acknowledging and understanding and seeing right from wrong, and to put us with those who are of the right, inshaAllah, with the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant.